information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, you can contact the Avalanche at @AvalancheCKUT or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsight, that's up next.
Stand with Wet'suwet'en. McGill University must divest from TC Energy. A community campus action on Wednesday, December 1st, taking place just inside the Milton Gates at James Square. With poetry, speeches, and music, McGill University invests over $4.7 million into TC Energy Corporation, the company that is building the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Indigenous Wet'suwet'en lands. Now is the time for McGill University to divest from TC Energy. Join us for a campus community action at 5:30 on Wednesday, December 1st. This event is co-hosted by Divest McGill, the Indigenous Student Alliance, and is co-presented by CKUT Radio. See you there.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair's week of podcasts featuring local, national, and international activists and authors. Due to the ongoing global pandemic, the Book Fair Collective decided to move their event online again this year. So for the second year in a row, From Embers is teaming up with the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair to release presentations over our podcast platform. Recordings of these voices of resistance were conducted on unceded Indigenous territories across so-called British Columbia and beyond. For more information about the Book Fair and a full schedule of online events this week, check out victoriaanarchistbookfair.ca. And listeners in the Victoria area are encouraged to visit Camus Books at 2620 Quadra Street or online at camus.ca for anarchist publications and more. And to find out more about our regular anarchist podcast, go to fromembers.libsyn.com or simply search From Embers in your favorite podcast app.
Hi, my name's Will. I'm a settler and a member of the Victoria Anarchist Book Fairs Collective, recording from unceded territories shared by the Lekwungen and Huasainich peoples. Today, I'm joined by Jennifer Wickham, a member of Kasiyik, the Grizzly House, and the Gidimden clan of the Wet'suwet'en people, and media manager for the Gidimden Yintah Access Point. Hello, Jen. Hadi. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Hadi, it's I, Jennifer Wickham Sydney, Gidimden Hazli Wet'suwet'en is Den. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much again for joining us. Last year, Molly Wickham, Slato, did an interview with the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair, giving updates about Coastal GasLink's construction ramp up during COVID-19, BC Premier John Horgan declaring that CGL employees are essential workers, and the threat CLG poses to Wet'suwet'en River. Are there any recent updates that you'd like to highlight?
Yes. Yeah, so on September 25th, SLATO and allies and supporters occupied the drill pad site where Coastal GasLink plans to drill underneath Wetzinqua. We chose this time because CGL has said in their plans that they will have that section of the pipe installation completed by the end of the fourth quarter. And based on the information that we have, it takes 79 days of 24 hours a day work for them to complete that section. And in order for them to do that, they would have had to have started weeks ago. And so folks have been holding it down and digging in for winter ever since, because it's really starting to get chilly out on the Inta. So, you know, we've seen SURG officers. There have been two arrests so far very early on in the occupation. Since then, we have had harassment and sabotage by the RCMP coming in, dumping out drinking water, locking ATV keys into a truck. They put out a fire and then dumped more drinking water the other day, and just generally harassing people, pulling people over on the Forest Service Road, giving tickets, impounding vehicles, all of their regular nuisance tactics, trying to intimidate supporters and members that are supporting our occupation at the moment.
I also heard that in addition to threatening members of the camps, CGL is also threatening the heritage and archaeological sites important to the Wet'suwet'en people. Can you speak to that?
Mm-hmm. So the week before the occupation of the drill pad site, the Coastal GasLink contractors went in and bulldozed and destroyed an archaeological site where there have been over 20 artifacts found from two different archaeological assessments. One done in 2015 and one done in 2019. And both of the recommendations from those assessments were to avoid the area. They did not. They said that there is no way for them to avoid the area and still build their pipeline. And so they brought in heavy machinery and completely bulldozed the site. And had an archaeologist on site to quote unquote supervise the work. And so the plan that they told us about was that they would excavate 10 centimeters of soil at a time, carefully and thoroughly inspect that soil before continuing on another 10 centimeters. And that is not what was witnessed by SLATO on site. The entire area was completely bulldozed, including tree stumps and bushes. And then the archaeologist was theoretically supposed to go through this huge pile of wreckage afterwards and find any archaeological evidence, which is in fact legal evidence of our occupation and use of that area. The report, it has not officially been submitted, but the word from other reporters that have called this company to follow up on the work, they're saying that they did not find any more evidence or artifacts during the dig, which is not surprising given the way that they so carelessly did the work.
And is this site on the banks of the Wet'suwet'en?
So the archaeological site is about 200 meters behind the reoccupation site at 44 kilometer at the Gidimden checkpoint, and which is on at the confluence of the Lamprey Creek and Wetzinqua. So it's not that far from Wetzinqua and is part of a larger archaeological network of trails and village sites, with a main village site being at the meeting of Lamprey Creek and Wetzinqua.
How has Coastal Gas Link's construction, you know, at the confluence of Wetzinqua and Lamprey Creek, affected the Yinta, affected the territory, and your ability to harvest in that area?
Well, days before they bulldozed the archaeological site, they actually destroyed a hunting blind that we had in the ravine in behind our Gidimden checkpoint. So they are impeding our ability to hunt and gather. They destroyed medicines and berries and everything in that entire area. The Lamprey Creek is actually named after the lamprey eel, which is on the species at risk list for BC. And they plan on, once they have, so they've completely cleared everything, including trees, bushes, medicines, and topsoil all the way down to the creek, where they plan to trench through the creek that the lamprey eels live. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the management of the Yinta and the territory, there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding over what hereditary governance means for the Wet'suwet'en people and how the territory is organized with hereditary chiefs and support chiefs. Could you share how the self-governance system of the Wet'suwet'en works?
Mm-hmm. So within the Wet'suwet'en Nation, there are five clans: Gilsehiu, Lhkxamseu, Lhkseliu, Tsayu, and Gidimden. And within each of those five clans, there's 2 to 3 house groups. And so each house group is responsible for different areas out on the Yinta. So Kasiach is 1 of 3 house groups within the Gidimden clan. And we are responsible for the territory where the Gidimden checkpoint is, all the way up to the Wetzinqua, which is the boundary line between Kasiach and Unist'ot'en territories. And each house chief is responsible for the management and safety of their house group territories. And so they would traditionally have, because they can't live on all of the territories, each house has multiple territories they're responsible for, they would have supporting chiefs that would help them look after those territories. So people would actually live out on the territories all winter, and we would only gather all together in the summertime when we would go to our fishing villages to replenish our food stores for the winter.
Thank you so much for explaining that. Instead of going to the hereditary chiefs, Coastal Gas Link went to the band council for approval to work on reserves. How would you contrast the Wet'suwet'en system of governance with the band council?
So the band council system is responsible for the pieces of land that the federal government quote-unquote reserved, so the reservations, for our people. And so there's different village sites that they pushed all of our people onto and made it a legal requirement for them to stay on. So Chief and Council is set up as an arm of the federal government. They have a forced system in place that mimics the federal system, where there's an election every couple of years where people will vote for chief and council. The issue with industry making deals with the chief and ban council system is that the ban council is really only responsible for the day-to-day maintenance of the reserve. There is no reserve land that the pipeline is going through. And so the authority over the 22,000 square kilometers of Wet'suwet'en Yinta has always been the hereditary chiefs. There was a court case won. We had a joint court case between the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitxan nations against the federal government over our rights and title. And the decision of that 1997 Supreme Court case was that the court decided that the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitxan had never relinquished their authority and jurisdiction over either of their territories. So knowing that, and knowing that the day after the decision came out and the information was accessed through an FOI by the Narwhal, and they found internal memos and emails between the different branches of the government to create a strategy on how to circumvent the decision so that industry would still have access to our resources and it would not limit anyone extracting those resources from our territory based on this very profound decision from the Supreme Court of Canada. So how that complicates things now is that we currently have a provincial court who has issued an injunction, not taking into consideration this decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, which is a higher court than them, stating that the hereditary chiefs, not ban council, but the hereditary chiefs were actually all plaintiffs in this case, have never given up their authority and jurisdiction over our 22,000 square kilometers of Yinta.
Speaking of the decisions that the federal government's made, specifically regarding the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, over the last year, residential schools have faced another wave of scrutiny for their role in genocide by the settler public after the report of over 215 children's graves found at the site of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School on Tecumloops Tehsilhqh'mq territory. Can you speak to the legacies of the residential schooling system in Wet'suwet'en Yinta?
Yeah, so we know that the residential schools were one more tactic that the federal government employed in order to displace and dispossess Indigenous people of their territory. So the Wet'suwet'en were just as affected as any other nation in having their children stolen and sent to residential schools. Mostly people from our communities went to the Lajak Indian Residential School, which is in the northern area. And, you know, we hear the stories. We hear of family members, you know, and friends and relatives, like, sending their children to residential school and those children never coming home and them never hearing whatever happened to them. There was no reason given. They just didn't come home. That, of course, you know, was intentional. And we now know it should be common knowledge that the reason for that was to kill the Indian and the child and dispossess them of their language and their culture and their traditions, because the government of Canada at the time knew, has always known, that if we are raising our children as Wet'suwet'en people, we will always defend our land because of our relationship to the Yinta itself, to manage the animals and the water and the berries and the medicine patches, you know, and those relationships that were built over thousands of years. We have a responsibility to that. And they knew that if the children were raised in their homes, learning their language and with that connection to the Yinta, that they would always be fighting us. for the resources that they wanted access to. And when it was apparent to them that taking children and sending them to school was not effective enough, that's when we saw the 60 scoop and the removal and theft of our children at even younger ages. And that continues today. The number of children in care of MCFD is higher for Indigenous children than the rates of children sent to residential school.
And the residential school that you mentioned north of the territory that most Wet'suwet'en children went to, is that the same school that CLG sort of retrofitted to be a accommodation for their workforce?
Yes. So currently the former Lajack Indian Residential School is now the grounds for a man camp. And, you know, we also, when all of the graves were found in Kamloops, so many of my own family members attended because at the time that was the only residential school that offered senior grades. So the senior high school grades, where most of the residential schools in the province only went up to grade 7. And so a lot of family members that went to Lajack were then transferred to Kamloops. So, yeah, it was a really emotional time. And we actually went and held a ceremony with the other northern communities at the former site. And it was really devastating to see all the man camp trailers and the infrastructure that they're building on that site, and possibly over the bones of some of our family members.
I wanted to ask about the solidarity between Indigenous peoples that you've experienced over the course of this resistance. We know that the struggle on Wet'suwet'en Yintah has sparked mass solidarity mobilizations, like last year's Shut Down Canada campaign that saw Indigenous peoples and settler supporters from across the continent engaging in solidarity actions. Can you speak to the solidarity shared between the Wet'suwet'en clans and houses, as well as with other Indigenous nations?
Solidarity and allyship between Indigenous people is such a beautiful thing. And it's so powerful because I think we recognize the shared history of colonization. We recognize the trauma and the pain and the loss and grief in each other and our experiences. And I think it's not a stretch. It's not a jump for other nations across Turtle Island to look at what's happening now in Wet'suwet'en Yintah and recognize that in their own history and in their own daily lives. So many people from other nations that don't have access to clean drinking water, that don't have access to hunting grounds, that don't have access to medicines and berry patches. You know, I have personally talked to people that have never tasted a huckleberry. They don't have berry patches that they can go to every year and harvest. They don't have medicines that they can go out and get. They have to travel hours and hours and hours to go moose hunting. They have waterways that they can't even swim in, let alone drink. And so I think that part of the reason why Indigenous people are standing up in support of what we're doing is because they recognize that and they have explicitly told us that if they knew how bad the destruction would have been, was going to be on their territory and how much they would lose, they would have fought harder and for us to never give up. And so there are many nations that are willing to stand up. And
how has COVID impacted resistance at the Gidimden access point and life on the Wet'suwet'en Yintah? It's been over 18 months since the pandemic started. I imagine the protocols have changed since supporters started coming up to camp, and that, you know, it's made life more difficult than the RCMP and CGL have been making it.
We definitely have changed protocols during the pandemic. So we have very strict COVID-19 precautions that we follow when folks are coming to camp. People are isolated from each other for 14 days before they can join into the main camp pod. So we do pods. And it has certainly hindered people's sense of freedom to move. And so there has been a lot of concern from supporters around rates of COVID in their area or in our area. And right now, you know, we did see over last winter, we did see a huge spike of COVID cases here in the north. And particularly within the CGL man camps, they were actually ordered by the provincial health officer to shut down for a while, which gave a bit of reprieve to our communities, to our land defenders, and as well as our medical systems. That didn't last as long as it should have. In my opinion, they should be completely shut down. We know from being out on the land and seeing all the workers, it's the majority of them have Alberta license plates. We know that a lot of workers are coming in from out of province and even out of the country. We know that, for example, in the Burns Lake section of the pipe, there are people in the man camp from Italy, for as one example. So we're definitely seeing an increase of COVID-19 right now in the province. And I don't think it's a huge jump to speculate that that is from the huge increase of COVID-19 in so-called Alberta and the workers that are migrating in from there to come to work in these man camps. All of the hospitals in the north right now are over capacity. They're flying COVID-19 patients from the north down to Vancouver and Victoria to the hospitals. They are overrun. In Smithers in particular, the COVID cases are really high. We're seeing it affect our small communities. We recently lost in our own family a matriarch. My grandmother's sister recently passed away from COVID-19. And, you know, there's just more and more reports every day of people that are testing positive in our area and in our communities. And it's really devastating because it's totally preventable. You know, if the workers weren't coming in and they weren't bringing COVID and they weren't working side by side with other people in our community, if they just took the precautions that are necessary for a global pandemic, our people would not be dying.
Has your community received enough vaccinations that they've needed as well? Or have those been in short supply?
All of the people that I know of so far that have passed from COVID-19 have been double vaccinated. It makes it really difficult to do this work when our families and our communities are grieving so much loss. And then to also be fighting for our lives and Orienta at the same time is difficult to say the least. I know that everyone is just as sick of the pandemic as we are, but it does add a lot of layers of complications as far as people coming to support us, and we are really diligent about ensuring everybody's safety, and Coastal GasLink and the man camps are not held to any of the same kind of standards that even our local citizens are. For example, there is a new restriction within Northern Health that if anyone in your household is not vaccinated, you're on lockdown for 2 weeks, except to go buy groceries. And I know from speaking to an employee for one of the contractors for Coastal GasLink that they are not required to show a vaccination passport to that they are double vaccinated in order to be in the man camps. So they're not held to the same standards that even our own communities are.
We've been talking a lot about struggle and resistance and the pain and grief that's happened to both the community and the Yinta. Can you tell me about the joyous experiences that come from living Wet'suwet'en law and enacting the jurisdiction of your nation and embracing the sovereignty of your peoples?
Absolutely. And the first thing that comes to mind is my 5-year-old niece. She has grown up out on the Yinta. My sister and her family have been living out at Hlutaspin since 2014. For the majority of my nephew's life and for all of my two nieces' lives. And the way that Yet Tohies knows the Yinta and behaves on the Yinta and projects her future on the Yinta is so beautiful. She, in behind the Gidimden checkpoint occupation site, she started to build her own cabin. And she set it up with a chair and teacups. And then Slato witnessed her digging a hole. And she asked her, "What are you doing?" And Yet Tahiez said, "Well, I'm digging an outhouse. My cabin needs an outhouse." And she knows who she is as a Wet'suwet'en person, and she knows that that's her territory. And if she wants to build her own home out there, that she has every right to do that. She knows where the berry patches are. She knows what medicines are there. She is out hunting with her dad and her mom and harvesting animals and doing ceremony. And, you know, she prays for the people and talks to the ancestors. And to me, that is really what it's all about. It's about our children and our future grandchildren being able to live as Wet'suwet'en people out on the land. And I don't even remember what question you asked, but that's what I can think of. That's what came to mind right away is my beautiful 5-year-old niece digging herself a little outhouse beside her cabin.
Oh, that's precious. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's beautiful. I wanted to ask, what sort of projects are currently underway at the camp that you'd like to share? I remember last year, Slato mentioned the construction of trapping houses at the access point. What other initiatives are underway?
Mm-hmm. Well, before the occupation of Coyote Camp. We are almost completed two tiny houses at Lamprey Creek, formerly the Lamprey Creek Rec Site, that have been outfitted with solar power, and we're just finishing the interior of it so that Gidim Den clan members have a place, a comfortable place to come and stay out on the Inta. We also have plans to build a feast hall out on the territory at the direction of our Denise Was. We have constructed a large indoor kitchen that was formerly inside a kind of small green tent. So we're pretty excited about that. And of course, you know, the plan and the dream is to build our village sites out on the Inta. We have an elder from Cassia that wants to build a home out on the territory. We have a young couple with a family that wants to build a home out on the Inta. And so those are projects that are in the future and in the works to happen. And, you know, we're doing everything that we can to reoccupy our lands so that these kinds of projects will not be able to bulldoze through our Yinta in the future.
Those projects sound fantastic. What kind of support are you looking for right now for people who can't necessarily get up to the Yinta? What can they do to ensure successful and ongoing resistance?
So if folks are not able to personally come and put boots on the ground out on the territory, maybe they have some financial means that they could contribute. We have had a couple of folks contact us and offer to pay for flights for people that, or gas and ferry costs for people that are able to come out to the territory. They want to sponsor Indigenous people. That's always an option. During the pandemic, building supplies have increased in cost, sometimes triple for some things such as like plywood and lumber. So financial contributions are always helpful. We also have a couple of campaigns happening right now. So we have submitted a letter to 35 of the investors and financiers of the Coastal GasLink and the LNG Canada projects. So that information is available on our website. There's also a media kit available so that folks can amplify that message. We have different actions on our website on the, I believe it's called What Can You Do? Or Actions to Take. Sorry, it's escaping my mind at the moment. But all the information is on our website at yintaaccess.com. There are, of course, always contractors that have offices in multiple cities that can be targeted. On October 29th, there is an international campaign against RBC, the Royal Bank of Canada. And we will be holding an action out on the territory and are encouraging folks to sign up and organize within their own communities. We, of course, always are asking folks to follow, like, share, and amplify all of our social media posts and really keep an eye on everything that's happening on the ground. You know, in in the event of enforcement that happens against our people and our people are removed from our territory, of course, solidarity actions will be called for. We really want to keep the pressure on Coastal GasLink, on the investors, on the contractors, because they do not have the free, prior, and informed consent of our people to be doing the work. So as much pressure as we can put on them, the better.
Then Houston, Jennifer, thank you. The Victoria Anarchist Book Fair Collective really appreciates you sharing your time and knowledge with us. We hope that this interview contributes to the mobilization of resistance against CGL, the RCMP, and the settler state going forward. Thank you for as well sharing about the future projects, and I hope that, you know, helps get people inspired to support and get boots on the ground up in the INTA.
Tebby Masai for having me.
We blockaded highways and we talked about not just marching, but direct action to shut this shit down.
Here we draw the line. Right here we say no more.
Yate, we invite you to join us for Indigenous Action, a podcast where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities in the occupied lands known as the so-called United States, or what many people recognize as Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Find us at indigenousaction.org and with the Channel Zero Network.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination, with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour. Polo and Pan, December 11th, Place Belle, one night only in Montreal. Get tickets now at eventco.ca. Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
changeable, accepting, merging water moves fluidly from one form to another, easily transitioning from cloud to raindrop to sea. Forever changing form, but not essence, water passes through barriers that are impossible to cross in any other way. Water knows no boundaries. Indiscriminately merging with anything and everyone, water unifies. It's in its nature to connect and merge. Water is generous, sometimes a little too generous, overflowing with bounty and causing a flood. Yet, a stable earthen container or seawall finds water committed to taking shape as a reflecting pool, cove, or lake. Just as the sea refuses passage to no one, water accepts all who come its way. Water accepts all walks of life, and we gratefully surrender and open to this healing element.
Thank you. good evening and welcome to Amandla. You're on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is your 1 hour African